President Trump forgets he has a legal team before tweeting he wants to move the federal election. Johnny Depp admits to being a habitual drug user and all-around bad guy in his defamation trial, and bar examiners have given up and resorted to handing out participation trophies, all in this week's Debriefing of the Law. Well, welcome to this week's Debriefing of the Law. I am Joel Oster, and welcome, Mackenzie Smith.
Thanks for having me again.
Now, we are on day, I believe, 150 of our worldwide global lockdown, going crazy through this pandemic. And, Mackenzie, I am just curious, what have you learned about yourself or maybe the world through this pandemic?
You know, I think I've learned how much I rely on socialization for my mental health and well-being. I just recently, I've been watching TV or movies or whatever, and whenever I see like groups of people, I have this like existential longing. And I'm not, you know, I'm an extrovert, if you haven't noticed, but I'm not a person.
I've noticed. You have not kept that secret.
Yeah. But I'm really not a person who needs to be around huge groups of people all the time, or at least I didn't think I was. But for example, my son and I were watching the movie Night at the Museum the other day, and I turned to him and I like halfway through the movie and I was like, God, I just can't wait to go to a museum. Like, when's the last time you felt like that? But I was like, I want to be at a museum with like hundreds of other people, just kind of, you know, feeling that vibe. Yeah, you totally
take me to a coffee shop.
Exactly.
It's almost like this. Tell me if you don't recognize this thought. Hey, because our world has changed so much in the last 5 months. But have you been watching a TV show and felt anger inside yourself going, they're not even social distancing. How can they do that? How irresponsible are they being? Like, dude, that show was recorded 10 years ago. They had no idea about social distancing 10 years ago. Or they're shaking hands. You know, really? Should you be shaking hands in today's day and age? I'm not sure that's a wise thing. But do you even remember what life was like 5 months ago?
It's hard to. I mean, it feels like I should have kept a diary more, or like taken more videos or something, because it really does feel like it's a lifetime away. Like, you know, another example is my family and I were watching the show Nailed It on Netflix, and the woman was putting frosting onto a cake, like with her bare hands, and then the judges were eating the cake, and all five of us were like, no, like, you can't do that. But yeah, it does seem like so many things have changed and will stay changed. Like, I was reading a survey about lawyers the other day, and it said 91% of lawyers who responded to the survey think that remote work will become like the norm in law firms and legal profession. Yeah, which makes me kind of sad.
But isn't it weird how fast things change and we just forget the way things used to be? For example, my kids would probably be aghast that back when I was growing up, we didn't have cell phones. So when we're out there playing, we're at the park, mom and dad have no idea where we are. We're just out there playing, and they're going to hope that we would come back come dinner time. But nowadays, I mean, you would never let your kids outside without their cell phones. Heck, I wouldn't even go to the grocery store today without my cell phone. You always have to be connected. It didn't used to always be that way. So it makes me wonder, what things now have we become so accustomed to in the last 5 months, we can't even envision life without doing it? For example, wearing the mask. I mean, is that now something that we are so used to that we wouldn't possibly dream of ever going back to that kind of society where we were maskless? Can you think of anything else like that, that we have now, society is never going to go back?
Yeah, I mean, definitely like standing in lines, I think you're just naturally going to be 6 feet away from the person. I hope. Right. I mean, I hate being in a line where the person behind you is like breathing down your neck. That's like one of the most uncomfortable situations, like in the grocery store line or whatever. But I think things like that definitely have changed long term, if not permanently. And some are good, but a lot of the changes are bad. And like, I've done that before where I intentionally leave my phone at home and I'll go run errands or whatever just to like not be glued to my phone the whole time. And people get kind of indignant. Like, they're like, I was trying to reach you and I didn't know where you were. And it's like, no, but that's how things always used to be. Like,
I know.
You know,
how
so
did we go
weird.
To the store? How did we go to the store without our cell phones? I mean, that seems like such a long time ago. Well, yeah, we definitely live in a different day and age, and I don't want to make things worse, but election season is upon us, so things are about to get worse. Like, if things are not bad enough with the killer hornets and whatever else you have going on in our society, it is almost time for the election season. And so, have you already started getting the ads there in Philadelphia?
I don't actually have cable TV at home, so we don't watch live TV. So I can't tell you if I'm sure there are TV ads. But I can tell you, I've been getting text messages already.
Right.
Random people asking for money. So yes, it's happening.
It is already, you're right, that we have gotten a lot of text messages. We also watch pretty much everything on Netflix or Amazon Prime, whatever. We fast forward through every commercial that there is. So we're not watching anything as far as the commercials or political ads, but we are getting them on our phones. So election season is just around the corner. Now, we're actually going to get to the headline news in the law this last week as we debrief the law. But before we get there, I wanted to throw in a new segment. I want to talk about, here's a question for the day. And maybe some of our listeners are curious about this. I want to address some of these questions in our various podcasts. Here's a question for today. Mackenzie, what do you think clients expect lawyers? Do you think clients expect lawyers to lie for them? Have you ever thought, have you ever had an awkward situation or a moment where you're talking to your client? Actually, I don't want you to give me an actual case with your clients, but just, do you ever think clients struggle with that? Do they think lawyers lie for them?
I think I'll start by saying I have never had a client directly ask me to lie.
Okay, directly.
Never. Directly.
Now, I like your use of the word directly. What do you mean by directly?
So I actually think the bigger problem is that clients aren't always, and in fact, oftentimes aren't honest with their lawyers. So,
oh, yes.
I just feel like I want to get the message out there loud and clear that, like, you know, I don't know if you ever watched the show House with Hugh Laurie or whatever. Great show. And he would always say everyone lies, right? Which is so true. Everyone lies. Everyone lies all the time. But people of the world, if there are two people you should never. Well, I guess three. If you're religious, you shouldn't lie to your priest when you're in confession because it totally like renders the
What's
entire
the
thing null and void. Yeah. So there's that. But there are two other people you should never lie to. Your doctor and your lawyer. And there's a couple reasons. Like, number one, they can't tell anyone anyway, right? Unless you're about to murder someone, which hopefully you aren't. And two, like, they can't give you the services that you're paying for and that you need unless you're fully honest with them. So, like, when a lawyer asks you a question, you need to tell the truth because it's going to change maybe the strategy of the case or whether they recommend that you settle the case. Like, there's a reason why they're asking you for the information. So I have been in a situation where I felt like my client wasn't being completely honest, and it's a pickle. Like, it's not a good situation to be in as a lawyer.
Now, I will just point out that you gave me a list of people that you should never lie to. I did notice spouse was not among that category. I'm just going to leave that one alone and move on.
I can explain. You brought up, no, it's okay.
That's right. But no, it's almost, there's no sense to lie to those, to your priest, to your doctor, your lawyer. The lawyer, it's going to handicap the lawyer in doing his or her job. Now, that's not always the case when it comes into criminal matters. Sometimes lawyers don't want to know the full truth, but still, don't lie to your lawyer. Just maybe say, you don't really want me to answer that question. I don't know, but you are definitely not doing your lawyers any favors by giving the lawyer the wrong information. That you don't want to lie to your lawyers. But I do this thing called man on the street interviews where I go, you know, with a TV crew, and we go out there on the streets of Kansas City, and I ask them various questions. And I also do this in a drive-thru setup. I'll drive, and we'll go to a drive-thru, like at McDonald's, and I'll ask them legal questions. So I'll ask them this question: do you think lawyers should lie for you? And do you know what the response generally is from the public?
Please don't tell me it's yes.
It's well, yeah, that's their job. God. That is what they more often than not say. They think lawyers lie for their clients. And I have had that awkward moment where I've been with the client, we're preparing for a deposition, and we're going over what their answer should be to a certain question. And there's this tension in the room as the client is trying to say, okay, is now the time you're going to tell me how to lie? Because I don't know when we're going to get into what my answer should be. I thought I was paying for the bigger lie. But nonetheless, I have had that awkward moment. So when you said, you know, directly, no one has directly told me to ask me to lie for them. But indirectly, I think I've definitely received that communication from my clients. So you think some clients do expect lawyers to lie for them, but that is just a bad idea. Is that your final take?
Yeah, I mean, and we can't, like, we're officers of the court. We owe a duty of candor to the tribunal. And I'm not, like, maybe I'm, you know, idealistic or whatever, but, like, I also
right.
am an Irishman. So, like, when I lie, I turn the color of a freshly boiled lobster. So okay. I can't lie for my clients because I would immediately turn several shades of red and everyone would know that it wasn't true. It's kind of a non-issue when it comes to me.
Well, it's a good thing that these are podcasts so far and not on YouTube, so we can't see the color of your face. But nonetheless, that is good to know for the future that when you do start to look like Bob the Tomato, that maybe we should not rely on your information. But yeah. All right. Well, lawyers, again, we have an ethical obligation not to lie to the court. And so, but do you find it interesting? I looked up the model rules for lawyers. There is a specific model rule saying you can't lie to the court. That's 3.3. There is a specific rule that says you can't lie to third parties. That's rule 4.1. There is a rule that says you can't lie to the general public. That is in rule 7.1. Did you know, Mackenzie, there is no specific rule for lawyers that says you cannot lie to your clients? Did you realize that?
You know, I'm not, like, that surprised by that, and I don't really know why. I mean, I know, like, we have a duty of loyalty to our clients and confidentiality, so that covers a lot. But I'm trying to think of a situation where you would have to lie to your client. I can't really think of one off the top of my head, and obviously you shouldn't about, like, I know of an attorney in my community who was disbarred for, like, things like, you know, telling your client that you filed motions that you didn't file. Like, you can't, that falls under other rules. You obviously can't do that. You can't tell them, like, oh, don't worry, we're winning. And, like, you never actually even filed their lawsuit yet. So I know that falls under other rules. So maybe that's why.
But maybe when the client says, hey, do you think I have a good case? Yeah, you do. They can't then somehow sue you for lying to them. I don't know why there is no specific rule on that, but you're right. Whenever you would lie to your client, that would probably be covered under a different rule. You have a duty of loyalty. The rule you just mentioned is the duty to inform the clients on a reasonable basis of recent developments in the case that they would want to know. So obviously you need to tell them what's going on in the case. So it probably would be covered under a different rule. All right, well, let's now hit the recent headlines. And since we've been talking about the coronavirus, and obviously it's a national topic, this hit my home or my area recently. And so it got me thinking, what are the legal issues when it comes to coronavirus? So let's just kind of do a recap right now. And so the first on my outline here, Mackenzie, would be President Trump this past week tweeted, now, right there, that's just a bad idea, right?
Absolutely.
President Trump, why does he have a Twitter account? I mean, do you not think that would be one thing that would unify everyone across this globe to take away President Trump's Twitter account? I think we all could be in agreement with that. Would you not agree with that?
I think even he, I can't remember, and I didn't listen to this interview firsthand, but my husband was telling me about an interview he saw with President Trump recently where the interviewer said, like, have you ever tweeted something and, like, immediately regretted it? And President Trump goes, oh, all the time. It's like, wait, why are you still doing this then? I don't understand. So, yeah, no, obviously. Like,
I think it
needs to be in the Smithsonian. Like, that's just going to be his presidential library. It's just going to be, like, a collection of his tweets.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, they someone should take that Twitter account from him. I've actually only done one tweet in my entire life. It was a couple of weeks ago. I wanted to just see what Twitter was all about. So I go on there and I do a tweet. And I was so excited, I put it on Facebook. Hey, I just posted my first tweet, which someone responded by saying, are you sure it's called posted? I don't think you used the right word there. But hey, nonetheless, I am learning. Well, he tweeted that maybe we should stall the upcoming elections due to mail-in voter fraud. And so, Mackenzie, this caused an uproar. Was there an uproar there in Pennsylvania about this tweet?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely saw so much online activity about it. You know, I don't really talk to people in real life anymore because that's the world we live in these days. But, yeah.
Hey, but the dog was upset.
A lot of angst spilled about it, for sure.
All right. I don't know why he did that, why he thought it'd be a good idea to say we're going to stall the election. Surely his campaign handlers were not too excited about that tweet. But since it is a national topic now, we're lawyers. Let's address it. Can the president delay an election? And if he did, if the election was delayed, what would that look like under our laws? Mackenzie, have you given that any thought?
So, I mean, when I read about this online, my initial thought is I didn't know, you know, despite being a learned constitutional scholar, I did not know
That's
off
right.
the top of my head. I couldn't, you know, render the constitutional provision that applied to this situation. But obviously, it didn't pass the smell test. You know, a president
right.
shouldn't be able to set the date and move around his own reelection day. So
right,
that
right.
didn't make sense. And then I did look into it a little bit, and it turns out it's right there in Article 2 where the power lies with Congress, not the president.
Yes, your gut did not lead you astray. It's Article 2, Section 1, Clause 4. I know I did not have that memorized. I had to look it up myself, but nonetheless, it's like that's what we do as lawyers, right? We have hunches. Our legal training gives us hunches where we say, I think the law says this, and then maybe we know how to go look up that law by Googling it. But nonetheless, Article
exactly.
2, Section 1, Clause 4 says—
You're giving away too much about what we do.
That's right. It says the Congress may determine the time of choosing the electors and the day on which they shall give their votes, which day shall be the same throughout the United States. So Congress can change the date of the election, but not the president. So clearly right there, we know that when President Trump sends out a tweet, he does not clear it through the legal department, right? He does not get clearance to make sure actually legally he can do what he is suggesting doing, but the president cannot move the election date. And maybe that calms some concerns by our listeners. I don't know. But Mackenzie, let's go ahead and let's play make pretend. Let's pretend that Congress, due to the pandemic, says, yeah, we are going to move the election date because we don't want people standing in line. Let's say the world really gets worse by the first Tuesday of November, whatever. What would that look like? What would happen if there were no next election in November?
Well, I think that's an interesting question because so the inauguration isn't until late January, right? So
I guess
the election could be held sometime between early November and late January and not really have too much of an effect on how the government is run.
Right.
But if it went past Inauguration Day, then I think there'd be a serious problem because it's also in the Constitution that the president serves a 4-year term. So the president's term would be over. Right. Constitutionally speaking, and no new president would have been elected. So I think at that point, you just have total mayhem. Like, I don't know. I don't practically speaking, for Congress to move the election, they would have to pass a law, right, which would require the Republican Senate and the Democratic House to agree on a law that the president would then sign. So I think we're just realm of the highly unlikely to begin with.
Now, I'm not sure on that, though. I have read articles this week by people who are supposedly much more learned than I that says it would have to be a law passed by Congress. But I believe I read that in the New York Times. But I'm not sure that's true, because the Constitution just says Congress shall determine. It doesn't say it has to be a law passed by the Congress and signed by the president. It just says Congress may determine. So I'm not sure the president does have to speak on that issue. But nonetheless, someone who is supposedly a lot smarter than me says the president would have to sign it. I'm just saying it's not there in Article 2, Section 1, Clause 4 of the Constitution. But now, one of the things that we kind of just glossed over is this doesn't just the election is not going to be just for the president. Now, the president will be, I believe his term ends there the end of January. I don't know what date, but this we also will be electing congressmen, you know, House of Representatives. And so they would be seated, I believe, the first or second week of January. So if we don't have an election, that also would be another operative time. Whenever Congress meets again, you would want to have people in the House of Representatives. So let's assume that that is going to be our critical date then, whenever the inauguration date is. What would happen if you did not have a president of the United States? Can Trump just stay in office afterwards until there's a new president?
Well, I don't think he can. So you'd have no House of Representatives. And so maybe right. This is all just an underhanded Republican plot to get rid of Nancy Pelosi. Like, I don't know.
Hey, I like it now. All of a sudden you have me in support of this.
So you wouldn't have a House of Representatives. But I think Mitch McConnell's also up for re-election this year, isn't he? So,
okay.
LOL,
all right.
Like, he's also out of there. So you got,
you know,
like,
I'll take that.
You got like 2/3 of the Senate that's still serving. You don't right. have a president, or presumably a vice president, which I guess, you know, there could be an argument that since Article 2 only speaks to the president, if he is rendered incompetent, then maybe Mike Pence would become the president automatically. I don't know, but there'd have to be someone to be the arbiter of that. And lo and behold, who would that be? The 9 lifetime tenure justices of the Supreme Court. So I think in that scenario, unlikely as it may be, the least dangerous branch becomes the most dangerous branch. And you've got you know, the kingdom of Brett Kavanaugh here or whatever.
So let's look at it. The only persons who would be legally in office at that moment of time, because the Constitution says the president will only serve for 4 years. So there is no provision for holdover. You are only president until a 4-year period runs, and then you don't have a president anymore. So it's not like Trump can just stay over. Everything he would do and say would be null and void. He no longer would be head of the military. He no longer could sign laws. He no longer could appoint people to various agencies. So who then would be legally in charge? As you pointed out, the 9 Supreme Court justices, they would be in position, right? Their tenure is not going to run out. The 2/3 of the Senate who would not be up for re-election, they would be in power. There would be no one in Congress. And so we would have a government of various bureaucratic agencies, a Supreme Court and various lower courts, and then 2/3 of the Senate, which I don't think they could do anything without anyone in the House of Representatives. And then you would have the military, various branches of the military that would be in operation. So that is what our world would look like. But nonetheless, it's not going to happen. But I got to tell you, Mackenzie, if you've ever wanted to write a fiction novel, I'm telling you, now is the time. Just grab this concept and run with it. Call John Grisham. I don't know, but this surely could be a great fiction novel. And if you could release it around, you know, November, it would be a bestseller.
I can just see it. I can just see like Chuck Schumer and Betsy DeVos like battling it out for who gets to run the country. And it's like, you know, we think we're already living in a nightmare. Like, oh my God, it could get so much worse. So let's just hope that, you know, they figure out an app that people can use to vote on November 7th or whenever the day is.
You know what? Things have happened in 2020 that we had no idea would ever in our wildest imaginations happen. I mean, you got the murder hornets, all those kind of things. It would not surprise me if you did not have an election in 2020 and we are run by the various heads of the military. But nonetheless, let's see what else is in the news this last week. The Supreme Court denied an injunction in the Calvary Chapel Dayton Valley v. Governor Sisolak case. In this particular case, a church, Calvary Chapel Dayton Valley, sought an injunction because Nevada had this law, Governor Sisolak, spearheaded it, that basically said that casinos could be open at about a 50% capacity, but churches could not. In fact, churches, I believe, cannot be cannot open up with less than I think 25 person capacity, some number like that, far less than the capacity for casinos. And so a lawsuit was filed trying to get this law to be enjoined. It was discriminatory as it was treating casinos much more favorably than the churches. The lower courts refused to issue that injunction. It goes to the U.S. Supreme Court in an emergency order, and in a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court denied that injunction and said, no, we are not going to interfere here. With Nevada has its own reasons for favoring casinos over churches, and so did not intervene. Now, did this case surprise you, Mackenzie?
You know, I was surprised that there are even churches in Nevada. I thought there were only those little wedding chapels that they have. So, yes, in that sense.
Okay, that's good. That is good. Where are they going to get married? Where are they going to get married in Nevada if they don't have these churches?
Wedding chapels have always had a drive-through option, which is, in retrospect, was very prescient of them. Like, if they didn't have to change their operations at all during the pandemic, they still do drive-through weddings. So, that's great for them. But
Divine. That was divine insight right there to have a drive-through. And I assume that drive-through is fine. That would not violate this governor's order. So, all right, go on.
Yeah, no, but I mean, I guess the cynical part of me, money talks, and obviously casinos I don't know this for a fact, but I would assume essential to the economy of Nevada. Yeah, it doesn't surprise me that they have been allowed to operate. I'm not thrilled with that, but it is kind of how they've chosen to structure their economy, and it is what it is. Like, I understand that too. You don't want the entire economy of the state to crater because it's so heavily dependent on that industry. So, I get it. It is what it is.
I got to tell you, Mackenzie, that is the winning line from today's podcast. Yeah, this case surprised me. I had no idea there were churches in Nevada. That has got to be the winning line from today's podcast. But maybe a close second is Justice Gorsuch said in his dissent that while the coronavirus pandemic poses unusual challenges, there is no world in which the Constitution permits Nevada to favor Caesar's Palace over Calvary Chapel. But again, that was in dissent. I was shocked by this case. Not for the reason you were surprised, though I definitely loved it. Your reason much better than mine. But normally you would win this case. If you were the church and you could point to some governmental law that said, yeah, these casinos, they can open at a 50% occupancy rate where you could sit down with some other person smoking cigars, whatever, drinking, gambling 24 hours a day. That's fine. You just can't meet for an hour in a church. Yeah, that's discriminatory. There is no way you would lose that case, but they lost this case. So that did surprise me. My one takeaway from that is this was an emergency injunction action. And so there will be an actual lawsuit that comes later on where after a trial on the merits. And so you might get a different decision after it's been fully considered by the court. But at least on a temporary emergency basis, the court refused to intervene in this case. So,
well, another thing is like a church. And look, I don't want to. I'm like a disillusioned Catholic. So I have no, I'm divorced. They hate me in that church, whatever. I have no room to talk about anything to do with religion or how religious institutions should conduct their services. But just thinking about it for a couple of seconds, like if you're a church, I know there is, there is sanctity in having your services inside of the church, but you do have an option. Like there's nothing, at least in the Catholic religion, there's nothing to prevent a priest from performing a mass service outdoors. right? And in Nevada, right, presumably you can be outdoors most of the year. So it's not an imminent harm to your ability to practice your religion, unless there was some evidence in the case that like it had to be indoors. Whereas a casino, you know, you can't just bring the casino outside. It kind of has to be indoors. So there's not really anything. Either you shut down and you lose, you know, revenue and have an impact on the state's economy, or you allow them to operate at some level of capacity. Now, I will say, my son was actually just in Vegas a couple weeks ago. He went to the national parks with his dad and their family, and he reminded me. I said, "Did you go into any of the casinos, or you know, most of the hotels have a casino in the lobby?" And he said, "Yeah. Did you know that people are allowed to smoke in there?" And I didn't realize that people are still allowed. That there's a smoking section of casinos. But if you think about it, you know, we've been having this conversation for the past several months about aerosolized viral droplets and things like that. If you just like smoking indoors is such a visual of how people's breath and like what they exhale just hangs in the air in this indoor space. Like you could actually see that you're walking through other people's breath. And when I had that visual, I was like, oh my God, I am not going into a crowded indoor space like for the foreseeable future. Like just now, thinking about what you're walking through is so gross.
That is interesting. Now, McKenzie, I am disappointed in your legal acumen here, because you immediately went to the why can't the churches meet outside, when instead I would have thought, why can't the churches not have a roulette table there in the front of the sanctuary? As long as you combined the communion with some kind of gambling slot machine, why can't they operate that way? Bring in the casinos, bring in the slot machines, bring in the blackjack table into the church building, and everything will be fine. Now, there's probably a reason why you did not think of that. You are a Catholic, though I think you said a disillusioned Catholic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's redundant, but nonetheless, I am a Protestant, and we believe in something that is really sacrilegious to you Catholics, and that is called the Sanctinasium. Have you ever heard of the Sanctinasium?
No.
We turn our gymnasiums into sanctuaries by just throwing a pulpit there in the front, so we don't really care about where we have worship service. We just have worship service anywhere and everywhere. So we'll say, hey, move the get the basketball hoop up to the ceiling, and then we're going to go ahead and do church here. We have no problems with that. I know the Catholics have a much prettier and ornate room to worship in than Protestants, but that's how we do things. All right.
No, we like to spend as much money as possible on churches and then preach about, you know, how like a rich man can't get into heaven, like an elephant through the eye of a needle or camel or whatever the biblical story is. But it's really, you have to have like constant visual reminders of the hypocrisy. Yes. That's like part of our faith, you know?
Well, I will say that I have gone into some Catholic churches. In fact, now whenever I visit a town, I'll make a point to go to a Catholic church, because I am so impressed with how beautiful and ornate their buildings are. But nonetheless, again, I'm used to Sanctinasium, so I come from a totally different perspective.
And it's cultural, you know, like it's all what you're used to. But I will say, like, there are so many, I mean, I lived in Italy for 2 years. Like, there's so many beautiful churches, and you know, I have no ill will there. Just the part where they like tried to kick me out of their religion. But other than that, like,
There's that. But I actually went to this church service, this Catholic church service, and I participated in it, which I got to tell you was very intimidating. Now, you're Catholic, so it's not as, you probably, this doesn't faze you one bit, but there's all kinds of kneeling and standing and turning around, and it's like, what? So I'm looking at those sitting around me going, okay, when are you going to kneel? When are you going to stand? I hope I'm not doing this the wrong way. Someone's going to expose me as being a Protestant here in this Catholic building, but nonetheless, it was a lot of fun. All right, well, speaking of interesting rooms and situations, this is a horrible transition, but nonetheless, let's get to the bar exams, because I do believe that that's also in the news of late with the coronavirus. What did you learn about the bar exams?
Yeah, so I guess the bar exam is always the last first week of July. I think the multi-states on Wednesday, which would have been this past Wednesday, and then the state exams are either on Tuesday or Thursday. I took the bar exam in 2009, so I can, there is a part of my brain that like still remembers that far back and how, you know, intense that experience was. But obviously, you know, and you're absolutely right. Like a casino, like a church, it's a situation where you have, or typically you had hundreds and hundreds of applicants for the bar exam sitting in a large room in a convention center, taking this exam for 8 hours a day for 2 to 3 days straight.
And thank you for giving me some love to that transition. I really stumbled through it, but you picked me up and I really do appreciate that. Right. But yeah, go on. Thank you for that.
You're welcome. That's what I'm here for. But yeah, obviously that, you know, couldn't happen or didn't happen in most states. And it is a state exam, so state by state. And I was just reading this week that in a lot of states, it was just a complete dumpster fire. So there were some states that were just like, okay, we're going to do it at home, but it's closed book and, you know, you have to have someone monitor you. Right. And then they realized like that was ridiculous. So they kind of just like, I can't remember whether it was Michigan or Iowa or what state it was that was basically just like, you know what, we realize that there's no ability to enforce this. So just take the entire exam open book and like email us the exam when you're done. And it's like, wait a minute. So they're not even verifying that the actual candidate is the person taking the exam. It's just like completely ridiculous.
So now they're taking bar exams at home, open book, and just email the results back?
That is what I read in several states. Like, it is completely ridiculous. I am personally offended because, like, you know, every other lawyer up until now, like, I had to go through the summer of hell studying for that exam and taking the exam. Like, it was god awful. And it's, you know, one of the barriers to entry to becoming a lawyer that, like, it's a rite of passage. You just have to go through it. And now there's going to be a bunch of lawyers out there that didn't have to go through it. And that just, you know, it makes me angry.
Oh, there's all kinds of horror stories. Like, I remember someone who really needed to be in a different room and could not write with a pencil. And they said, no, it doesn't matter. You can't use a computer to take this exam. We can't allow for the slightest deviation that would somehow impugn the integrity of the legal profession. We've gone from that to, just take an open book at home. Maybe have Johnny Cochran come over and take part of the exam for you, if you will. You know, but we don't really care. We have given up. I can't believe that now they're doing open book at home law school bar exams.
Well, Johnny Cochran's dead. So if you have him coming and taking the bar exam for you, you deserve to pass. Like, I am just fine with that person.
Then you have some special powers there. Right? Yeah, yes. Right.
I mean, he obviously did. He got OJ off. So, you know, whatever. But that's a whole nother podcast. But yeah, it's just a crazy, I mean, I think it kind of embodies the vibe of where we are as a society right now, which is pretty much just completely throwing in the towel and not caring about anything anymore. Like,
well, let me go ahead and give another horrible transition. Then you're talking about the bar exam, and we're kind of reliving the nightmare of when we had to take the bar exam. And I can remember how nerve-wracking it is. But nonetheless, there supposedly was a reason for that. They wanted to produce the top of society. If you're going to go there in court and argue on behalf of other people, they want to make sure you are fully qualified. That being said, let's now transition to Bearden v. Ballard Health case. Did you read this opinion? I sent it to you this past week.
I did, and it just made me, it was like a bright spot in my week, I have to say, because I don't have the quotes in front of me, but like, hopefully you'll read some of them. I personally, like, I'm a big stickler for legal writing. I really, like, I write a lot in my job, and I feel like as a litigator, I see a lot of bad writing that's submitted to courts. And it's, you know, it's not like I'm the best. I'm not writing the next great American novel here or anything. But I personally am of the belief that, like, legalese and all this convoluted legal writing, like, it's so annoying. No one likes to read it. Judges have so much paperwork to read. They're not, it, it's 99% of it is so boring, like no one would ever want to sit down and read the stuff, that, you know, it's not a bad thing to inject some kind of color and
colorful
maybe, like,
language,
a giggle here or there, like in your legal writing. Like, we can have fun too. Like, you know, not in like a death penalty petition, but you know what I mean? Like, most cases, you don't have to take yourself so seriously. You can write in plain English and have a little fun with it. But I think the lawyers, the plaintiff's attorneys in this case, went a little bit too far.
They might have, that when the court, I'm going to read for you the very first sentence the court wrote in its order. This is what the court said. As our court has previously explained, which, by the way, that's kind of fun. I wonder what the previous case was. The court did not mention it, but nonetheless, as our court has previously explained, there are good reasons not to disparage your opponent, especially in court filings. So right there, you know, this is going to be an interesting order. If the judge is starting off by saying these guys can't even agree with one another, they are insulting one another, this is going to be an interesting read. Now, the facts of this case, we're not going to belabor because it's just quite boring and not relevant. It has to do with antitrust action. So two companies merging together, is it an antitrust violation? Again, that's not the relevant part. The interesting part is the manner, the colorful language that one side used to describe the other side. So let me just go ahead and read for you some of the their colorful language. Here, I'm going to read. They said that MEAC surrendered to Ballard much in the manner that Marshal Petain surrendered France to Adolf Hitler. All right, right there, Mackenzie, it's not a good idea to compare anyone to Adolf Hitler. That's just not a good look. I get why you might want to do that for the extreme. You're just not going to look reasonable when you compare any side to Hitler. Would you not agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, especially when you're talking about, like, a merger. Like, we're not...
Yeah, right. Yeah. Neither side is Hitler. I know
mean,
you
if
wanna...
they were committing genocide, then, you know, it might be a fair comparison. But we're right, talking about, like, a corporate merger here.
All cases outside of genocide, just refrain from doing the Hitler comparison. It's probably going to look like you're doing a slight overreach. That's what I'm suggesting here. It might be perceived as a slight overreach. All right, well, the court goes on. That the Ballard merger was an octopus which was birthed by two individuals on one of the local golf courses while they were walking down the green fairways of indifference to the health, safety, and welfare of millions of people. All right, well, that's not too bad. I mean, I like the octopus reference there. A little bit of colorful language, but again, the court was not too happy with that language and actually criticized it. All right, let's go on here. How about this one?
I think green fairways of indifference to the welfare of millions of people, like, that is, I mean, that's, like, literary.
I really have
a vivid mental image of two, like, billionaires smoking cigars, walking down a fairway, laughing at the plight of the ordinary American. I mean, I kind of like that visual.
That's not too bad. Not too bad. How about this one? That Ballard and MEAC are intertwined in a incestuous relationship, the likes of which have not been seen since the days of Sodom and Gomorrah. All right. There, they probably went too far, right?
I mean, look, I don't know who these attorneys are who wrote this, but, like, you know, it takes some gumption to, like, submit this. And it, you know, this was in a complaint, right? So these are allegations.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, how do you, as a defense attorney, I'm thinking, like, how do you respond? Like, what's your answer? Like, you know, the paragraph 3 does not contain any allegations of fact and merely just characterizations.
Right.
Like, it's just so, it's not. I mean, it's funny when you read it, but, like, the lesson of this is, like, this is not good advocacy. Like, when you write a complaint,
no.
It's not a brief. A brief is a place to use, like, some colorful language and descriptive terms and stuff. But when you're writing a complaint, this is a document that's supposed to contain concise allegations of fact, which are things that happened, like events that happened. You can't just throw in all these adjectives and adverbs and, you know, things like that. Like, they're not allegations of fact. And actually, I think a complaint like that is pretty insufficient legally and could probably be easily subject to a motion to dismiss. So it's bad advocacy, first of all. But I got a laugh out of it.
You're right. It is about advocacy and persuasion. And when you start comparing something to an incestuous relationship, the likes of which had not been seen since the days of Sodom and Gomorrah, yeah, you're losing credibility. You just are. So if you're making a checklist on things not to include in your pleading, you already have the Hitler reference and the Sodom and Gomorrah reference as well. And maybe this last one here might be a third reference. And it says, again, I'm quoting from the court, that the Tennessee Department of Health's failure to supervise the defendants is akin to the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation allowing criminals to rape, murder, pillage, loot, and plunder on its watch while its agents stand by. Now, I'm just going to assume the comparison to a rape, probably not the best comparison to make in this context. What is your thought?
Yeah, that's kind of like, you know, it's a Trumpian statement. It reminds me of when Trump was like, oh, Mexico's sending over rapists and criminals. And it's like, yeah, there's a credibility issue with a statement like that. Like, you know, no one's going to take that at face value. It's not a statement of fact. So like, what a ridiculous, like, who are these lawyers? It's what a ridiculous thing to put in a complaint. You know, the client should definitely get their money back. You know, and it's probably sanctionable. I don't know. I don't know how this case will turn out in the long run, but it's definitely, you know, crazy things happen in litigation, and it gives me a chuckle for sure.
Right, right. Well, we will put a copy to this order in our show notes for today's podcast so that you can read the rest of it. But there are many references to octopus, octopi, and the shooting out of purple ink on paper, whatever. It's a very interesting read. But nonetheless, yeah, I teach this class on legal writing storytelling, where we basically talk about how to incorporate storytelling principles into one's legal writing. This is a great example of going too far. You don't have to have this kind of imagery. This is going to cut against your credibility and hurt your storytelling ability. All right, let's move on now to, I know, one of your favorite stories from this past week, the defamation trial involving Johnny Depp. Now, are you a Johnny Depp fan?
I'm a Pirates of the Caribbean fan, so I guess by association, I'm kind of a Johnny Depp fan. Didn't really, Edward Scissorhands creeps me out, but I'm not like, you know, it's not like I had a poster of him on my bedroom wall when I was a child, but obviously like child of the 80s and 90s,
right.
know, Johnny Depp is a huge celebrity and I'm into and always have been into celebrity gossip. It's one of my, you know, kind of ways that I unwind after a long day. It's very mindless and, you know, I like to keep up with it. So whenever there's celebrity gossip that kind of merges with the legal world, I'm all over it. And I have been following this case. It's a very interesting case.
Well, I don't know how much Johnny Depp's real life demeanor mimics his portrayal there in Pirates of the Caribbean, but go ahead. What are the facts? What happened in? Why was he on trial for defamation or slander in the UK?
So So the first thing to know is this trial is going on in Britain, which, you know, it is a legal system that is similar to ours here, but there is a lot that's different. So basically what happened is from 2015 to, I think, 2017, Johnny Depp was married to an actress named Amber Heard. And when they were going through their divorce, she made a lot of allegations against him that he abused her physically and otherwise. And then he kind of made allegations back, and it was like this horrible, messy, awful divorce. There were cheating allegations, and the whole thing was just like a nightmare. And I guess one of the most prominent British tabloids, which are notorious for kind of raking celebrities over the coals, they published an article and they called him a wife beater. And they didn't say, you know, alleged wife beater, Johnny Depp, or reported wife beater. They just said, basically, Johnny Depp is a wife beater, is my understanding. I haven't read the article firsthand. So he is suing them for libel and, you know, wants money damages because he's saying that they ruined his reputation and it's not true. And what's interesting about defamation cases is, you know, usually when you get to a trial stage, you have what's called a trial within a trial, because the actual issue is whether the newspaper printed something that was false about him. But in order to figure out whether it was false, we obviously have to put on trial, like whether he beat his wife. And so you had testimony from Amber Heard and Johnny Depp's ex-wife and also Winona Ryder, who was his girlfriend back in the early 90s. And it's just been like a circus of celebrity testimony and crazy allegations. Just crazy.
So from a client's objective here, you got to look, why would you even bring this case in this first place? Well, one reason why you might bring this case is that if in today's day and age, if you are known as a wife beater, your career is done. I mean, you can hardly hold any position if you are known as a wife beater. So if that allegation has been made credibly against you, even uncredibly, if it's been levied against you in a public setting, you almost have a duty to fight that back, or else you are never going to be employed again. And so from that perspective, he thought, well, if I file this lawsuit, this will be an avenue that I can fight these charges, present evidence, and maybe even if he doesn't win the case, but scores some points saying I wasn't beating my wife, then that might save his career. I mean, I don't know what his actual objective was in this case, but the trial within the trial is somewhat of a nice thing for him to clear his name. Well, what happened in the trial? You said they had Winona Ryder show up and testify. Is this over with?
Yeah, right. So my understanding is that Winona Ryder and Johnny Depp's ex-wife both testified that he, never did anything like that, that they would find it very hard to believe. And he does have kids. They're older now. I think they're, in their late teens or early 20s. But that might be another reason why you would want to fight something like this, to kind of clear a name and show that you weren't behaving this way. However, during the course of the trial, part of his defense is that, like, he is a habitual drug user. And, everyone kind of agrees with that. There were text messages that came out between Johnny Depp and another actor talking about getting drugs and doing, all kinds of drugs and stuff like that. So I don't know why you would want all that to come out, although it wasn't, a very well-kept secret to begin with. Like, everyone kind of knew that. Right. But I don't think doing any favors for his reputation, to be honest, no matter how it comes out.
But that is true, though, right? In Hollywood, you are still employable if you're a drug dealer. I mean, they don't have any drug user. They might have a problem with a drug dealer, but a drug user, Hollywood doesn't really care about that. In fact, Hollywood maybe assumes that you are disabled and you are suffering. So you have a sympathy. If you're trying to get help for your situation, maybe there's some sympathy. I'm thinking of the guy on 2 1/2 Men. The lead actor there was notorious for his... Charlie Sheen, notorious for his drug use, and everyone was fine with it until it got to a certain point that it interfered with his ability to even do his show. I guess there is some line to be crossed there, but not a wife beater. I mean, if the thought was, let's admit that we are a habitual drug user, that's a price we're willing to take, a risk we're willing to take to clear our name from being a wife beater. Because if you're a wife beater, then you are never getting another job in Hollywood.
Yeah, and it is, it's kind of crazy because I guess he, there were some text messages that he didn't produce in discovery and he ended up getting sanctioned when they came out in court. But then on the other side, his ex-wife Amber Heard, who was making all of these allegations, said that she never cheated on him. But then he came out with security footage from their residence that shows her entering the residence with another actor that she was co-starring with at the time. So, I mean, I think the bottom line to this case is, like, if you are feeling bad about your relationship, read a little bit about this case. It will make you feel a lot better. These people are bonkers. Like, they're totally wild. I mean, it's just a little insight into how different celebrities' lives are than the rest of us, because when you start reading about the lifestyle that these people had and the crazy drama day in and day out and all kinds of drugs and abuse and cheating, it's like a bad novel. I mean, I just can't even believe that people live lives like this. And how can you not be so stressed out, like, all the time living this lifestyle? So if you feel bad about yourself, read a little bit about this case. I think they had closing arguments this week, but they're not expecting a verdict for a couple weeks. So it is pretty interesting because there have been several high-profile cases, defamation cases against tabloids lately. I think Prince Harry and Meghan have another one going on. So it seems like more celebrities are starting to take these kind of publications to task and like try to hold them to a higher standard of truthfulness and reporting. So it will, from a legal standpoint, it will also be interesting to see how these cases turn out.
Yes. Because these media people, they have tricks that they like to play. For example, they'll have someone post on Facebook or on some social media site that this person did some horrible act. And so then the mainstream media would report that, oh, it's been reported that Prince Harry is a whatever. And so they can get around it by saying it has been reported, and they never cite their sources, really. They don't have to cite their sources. And so they are in the clear. So it's those little words or phrases that they use, like allegedly or reported, that they think insulates them from liability. But when the reality is, in today's day and age, if you read that it's been reported that someone beat their wife, that person is now a wife beater. In your mind, you assume they are, and they are guilty until proven innocent. That's just the world in which we live, which we know in the court of law, that is the exact opposite. You are innocent until proven guilty, or at least presumed innocent until proven guilty. So there you go. That is the Johnny Depp case. We will update you whenever we get a verdict in that case. There's two other legal issues I want to just run by you. One, in the Michael Flynn case. Have you been following the Michael Flynn case?
Well, I was initially, and then it just kind of became diluted in all of the other craziness that's going on. So I haven't heard any updates recently, so you'll have to tell me.
Here's what happened. So there are some criminal charges brought against Michael Flynn, and he pled guilty to them as a way to kind of get out of an investigation. And there were some issues as to whether or not some underhanded techniques were used by the prosecution to obtain that guilty plea. And so then Michael Flynn wanted to undo that guilty plea. And now that you have, a different prosecutor involved, they then decide to drop the charges against Michael Flynn, because I guess things came out about outing of Michael Flynn. But nonetheless, the court, in a very unusual move, said, well, I want some amicus to come in, which is a non-party to the case, some outsider to come in to present argument to help the court out. So the court wanted to have an argument as to whether or not these charges should be dropped, which was highly unusual for a court to do that, to request additional argument when the prosecution wants to drop the case. Well, that got appealed over a mandamus action was filed with the appeals court saying, look, we shouldn't even have a hearing on this. These charges should be dropped immediately. This case dismissed. The prosecution does not want to pursue this case, and so you can't pursue it. The court hands are tied. In the American system, the courts cannot be the prosecutors. They cannot pursue charges. All the court can do is be a court and a judge whether or not someone is guilty of a crime. But they actually cannot prosecute crimes themselves. That's a much different system than like over in England. But nonetheless, that is our system here in America. And so that the appeals court granted that mandamus and said, okay, no, we're going to send this case back with specific instructions to dismiss these charges. So that it brings us to this past week, where the judge then, who wants to have this hearing and have this amicus party argue the case of whether or not the charges should be dropped, sought an en banc review of this appeals court's decision, which means we want the entire court, which is 11 judges, I believe, there in the District of Columbia, to review this matter. And en banc was granted this past week. So this case is going to survive for another probably at least 3 months as this case is argued and presented to an en banc panel. So I guess the bottom line there is this will not be resolved before the election. But nonetheless, that is the Michael Flynn saga is ongoing. One
but
last thing.
But hadn't he already pled guilty? I mean, I understand like if a prosecutor files an indictment and then says, okay, I'm not going to pursue this for like whatever reason. But in this case, my understanding is he had already pled guilty and been sentenced, right?
No, I don't think we went to the sentencing. We had the guilty plea.
Okay.
And before sentencing, he moved to undo the guilty plea. And then the prosecution before sentencing said, we're not going to pursue this anymore. And so it's in that context that then the court said, we're not going to dismiss this case right away. We want to hear from this amicus party as to why these charges should not be dropped.
But I think a court can do that, because when you have a plea, so presumably he pled open, which means there was no, maybe he didn't, I don't know. Either way, he pled guilty, which means the prosecutor has to come into court and read to the court the facts of what the allegations are that he did. And then he has to say, yes, I did that. And therefore, I'm pleading guilty to these charges. So in that context, it's not just allegations. Now we have, it's as if a jury has found him guilty of doing these things. They're established facts that the prosecutor says happened and Michael Flynn says happened. So then when both right. parties come back after the fact and say, actually, that didn't happen, there's a problem with someone being dishonest about, were you lying before or are you lying now? Because you both said that these things happened and now you're saying that they didn't happen. I mean, the only way to undo a guilty plea is if you didn't know what, I mean, he knew what he was pleading guilty to. He's a sophisticated actor. So, you know, he doesn't really have an argument that my attorney didn't explain it to me, or I didn't know what I was doing, or I was insane at the time. I mean, there's kind of like narrow grounds that you can withdraw a guilty plea on, is my understanding. So there's something, I mean, I think it's obvious what's actually going on, but I don't like it. I don't like what the prosecutor is trying to do here. And I think, like, if we allow a system where just because you change, there's an election and there's a new prosecutor, or, you know, a change out in personnel, that's not how prosecution should go. It should be based on the facts and the law, not based on who's your political ally and who's not. So I don't blame the district court for being very skeptical about this. And it'll be interesting to see how it turns out ultimately.
And the interesting thing about it is almost all sides agree these charges will be dropped. That's almost not even the issue before any of the courts. The issue before the courts is whether or not the court can have a hearing where they just kind of explore the reasons why. Because if there's some undue influence by one side, let's say there was a bribe that was paid off to the prosecutor, right? That's something that the court would want to know before it ruled. So the court's not saying we're going to deny this motion to dismiss. We just simply want to know why. And right. so it's really an odd issue. Now, the other thing is, we know from the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the court does not want to appear to be political. But I don't see how the courts escape looking very political in this case, because the three-judge panel that ruled on the mandamus action that ordered this case to be dismissed, it was two Republican appointees and one Democratic appointee. Well, the entire en banc panel, I believe, is eight Democratic appointed judges and only three Republican appointed judges. So I'm just going to call it right now. The en banc panel is going to undo what this 2-1 panel ruled, and it's going to look very political. But I just, again, I'm not sure what side I fall on from the legal standpoint. If all the court really is wanting to know is, look, why are you dismissing these charges, and they just want to know, then what's the harm in them asking? And surely by filing this mandamus action, it has now elongated this whole process by months and maybe even half a year to a year, when the original hearing would have been held in July and would have already been over with. So this case would be dismissed today if this mandamus action had not been filed. So nonetheless, it's going to be a very interesting case to see how it finally is resolved. Lastly, it may be of pertinent interest to you, especially because I know you, this is your idol. RBG was in the hospital again this past week for a minimally invasive non-surgical procedure at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. Apparently, there was a bile duct that was originally placed at the facility in 2019, and this was just a little bit of work to revise that bile duct stent. And so, hey, everything is good. She is doing well, and so no need to worry, and let's hope this does not become a campaign issue. Any other thoughts as we conclude our debriefing of the law from this past week?
Well, look, I mean, if there is no election in November and we have to go to some kind of renegade government, like, my vote is for RBG to be, I'm like on her, I'll join her army to rule the country, because that lady does not quit, and she's amazing. And, you know, every time she's hospitalized, everyone kind of gasps, but she always comes out, and she's like doing push-ups a week later. So she's really amazing. I'm on her team. Yeah, that's my final thought.
She's definitely a miracle. The Energizer Bunny keeps going and going and going. The Notorious RBG is doing well. So thank you so much. That is our debriefing of the law this week. And I guess we'll just come back next week and see what else fascinating is happening in the world of law. So have a good week, Mackenzie.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law. I want to give a special shout out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom this entire operation would be a complete and utter mess. Our marketing team of Redbird Solutions and Leanne Holmberg for spreading the good word about us. Sean Wynn and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do. And Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.